This season of Tango Tango is brought to you by CareSource Military and Veterans. Military families move mountains. Healthcare should keep pace. This TRICARE open season, if you live in the Atlanta or Tampa areas, you have a new option, the TRICARE Prime Demo by CareSource Military and Veterans. It offers no enrollment fees for your first year and no referrals for network care. It's a choice you've earned. Visit CareSourceMilitary.com to find out more. CareSource Military and Veterans. Care you deserve. A choice you've earned.
Keep the faith, find a mentor, and find your place, because this country today needs more veterans in leadership positions. We need more veterans in C-suites. We need more veterans in politics. We need more veterans in any leadership position in the community, because I think there's a sense of common sense that you have and a strength that you have to make this country a better place and where it needs to go. And so be strong in who you are, be confident in who you are, and find your new tribe, because it exists.
Welcome to the Tango Tango podcast. Real, raw, and unfiltered conversations with veterans and those who support them. Tune in, be inspired, and walk away stronger.
I'm your host, Lloyd Knight, and this podcast is going to be great. We have one of my good friends and fellow veteran leadership presidential scholar, Brandon Wilson. But before we get into that, I just got to thank my sponsors over at CareSource. So CareSource, you mean a lot to me. You're not only hosting this podcast, but I'm also one of your clients, and I'm absolutely loving the treatment I'm getting with CareSource. Brandon, welcome to the Tango Tango podcast.
Awesome, buddy. Thanks. Glad to be here.
I'm really excited that Brandon's on here for many reasons. First of all, Brandon is the biggest veteran advocate out there. He's doing amazing things for veterans and their families in the state of North Carolina and nationally at all levels. And he's like the Swiss Army knife. Like, he can operate tactically like most Marines, but you can also put him in front of Congress and he's going to testify and he's going to get in there and make things happen. But really, most of all, why I'm excited is Brandon and I bonded on the bus ride, on our very first bus ride at the Bush Institute last year. And Brandon, do you want to let the viewers and listeners know how we bonded?
I'd sure love to, Lloyd. I think it was sort of divine that we even sat next to each other on that bus. And upon the conversation of me and you talking, I think one of us said to the other one, well, it didn't take you as long to get here as it did me. I was like, well, I don't know. I think it may have. I actually think I took longer. And come to find out, both of us had applied to the Institute not once, not twice, but three times before we were actually chosen. And so we sort of bonded a little bit over the fact that both of us have this sense of resiliency and persistence that we saw as a kindred spirit. Either one of us were willing to give up to get on that bus that day.
Yeah, your memory is short. We got shot down three times, bud. We applied four times.
That's what I'm saying. It took us three times being told no before the fourth time we got in.
We were going to burn the place down if they didn't let us in the fourth time. I started feeling like the cheerleader that sat in the back of the parents' car and getting the text messages that they were turned down each year. Where were you at when you found out you got accepted?
I was sitting right here in the office I'm in right now. I got the email in, and part of me was like, it was a mistake. Like, I don't think they realized what they just did. Like, did I really get in or not? Like, are we sure about this? But I was really excited about it after being turned down three times previously. And then the fourth time getting it, because I thought after the third time, the third was a charm. I'm not willing to get in. And it wasn't until my good friend Kim Mitchell, who's another presidential scholar, when I talked to her and said, they turned me down for the third time. This is in my cards. And she highly encouraged me to apply again. And so I'm glad I did. I'm glad I got to do that, because I never would have met you. And I never would have met a lot of other awesome leaders and have learned so much from that institute.
I'm glad you got in too. I think it was divine. As you mentioned, I think it was divine that we sat next to each other and bonded. Our fellow classmate, you know, Mark Riley and KC, we're bound, you know, we're guided by our faith. Yeah, I think it's amazing. And I think you were such a good fit for the Institute. And one of the things about Brandon, so Brandon is from North Carolina. He's going to tell a story a little bit. So I can honestly say folks looked at Brandon and they kind of blew him off at first. It was like, He's a Marine. I took him four times, and he's a redneck from North Carolina. But people quickly figured out that Brandon is a powerhouse. Not only is he doing these big things, but he's got all these amazing connections. Again, as I mentioned, you're a Swiss Army knife. You can operate in any room. And folks, the 36 classmates, including me, figured out very quickly that they shouldn't underestimate you. And so we're going to talk a little bit about your story and how you got to that. So as I mentioned, grew up in North Carolina. What part of North Carolina, Brandon?
Little town called Brevard, North Carolina, county of Transylvania County. Not a big county seat at all. Small town, rural town, manufacturing and farming was a big part of my bring up there in Brevard. I had a really good childhood. My grandfather was a deacon of a church for over 70 years. So faith was ingrained in me at an early, early age, along with my grandfather and father raising me up. Hard work was a big piece of my upbringing. So I was really blessed. I was really blessed in a way that we didn't have a lot, but we were rich, if that makes sense to a lot of people in the world that understands what that means. I was grounded in faith. My grandfather served in World War II as an engineer on a B-24 Liberator, dropping bombs on Hitler. My dad served in the Vietnam era, in the Air Force. He was not a Vietnam veteran. He served all of his years in the military stateside with the Air Force. My great-grandfather served in World War I for the Army. So we have a rich history of service. None of us were retirees. All of us just did our part of service and did our one or two term enlistments and come home to be servant leaders in our own local communities. But great, great childhood. I was fortunate enough to play a little bit of sports, and I went to Appalachia State on a scholarship, and that ended up not being the thing. As you're well aware of, Lloyd, I'm not exactly a large figure. I have a very Napoleon attitude about my 5'5" height on any good given day, but it was a great experience. I played sports, I hunted, I fished, I was in church. I learned the value of selfless leadership and sacrifice, and so that sort of just led my way into the Marine Corps and what I'm doing today and leading more myself to the community.
Well, we'll get to that story. But first of all, I got to say, the real Rudy was a fraud. You are the real Rudy, my friend. So it's not scripted for Hollywood, man. You're the real deal. So did you play football, Brandon?
I played football in high school, baseball, basketball.
So what position? I bet you were a linebacker, weren't you?
Sure thing. Yeah. I was more of a punt returner and free safety there, Lloyd.
Okay. I could
and that was dangerous.
I could see you hitting the snot out of people.
Well, I would try.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you went to Appalachian State. What was your goal at Appalachian State? What were you studying?
The only reason I went to App State was to play ball. I'm young. I thought I was invincible. I went to App State to play ball, and I found out really, really quick that dream was over. When you are as little as I am, regardless of how talented you may be or how much heart you got, size and speed mean a lot. And so I was really fortunate, though, that I found that out in a way that wasn't exactly the way I'd wanted to go. I got injured and realized I couldn't play anymore. But at the same time, I had a really good friend of mine who was actually a professional hunting guide, a little older gentleman. And he told me, hey, come with me on your winter break and you can make a little extra bucks up in Michigan being a hunting guide with me and I'll pay you. And I was like, all right, let's do that. So I did that. And that really turned into something that I thought, man, I can get paid to do something that I've done all my life, which was hunting. I'm just an old Appalachian boy. And so that led me into dropping out of Appalachia State at the time and going into a short career where I was a professional hunting guide and hunted all over the United States in Michigan, Wisconsin, upstate New York, New Mexico, the coast of North Carolina. And it put me all over the place doing something that I love to do, which was some great stories and just unbelievable people I got to meet along the way.
Show us your finger.
Right, there's my finger.
So, hunting. So he's got a great story. If you ever meet Brandon in person, tell him to tell you the story about how he got a finger. It's the funniest thing that happened in our 6 months at the Bush Institute. It was a hilarious story at the end of a storytelling block. And I can tell you, Brandon is the master storyteller. So tell stories better than Amy Griffin. It was one of the funniest stories that I've ever heard, but I want to spend the time and get in to talk about your Marine Corps story. So what led you to join the Marines?
I was really, like I said, I was really blessed, and I'd been a hunting guide for probably close to four and a half, 5 years when a childhood friend of mine, Charlie Bagwell, helicopter got shot down in Afghanistan. And when that happened, I come home for his funeral, and I just got to thinking, my great-granddaddy served, my granddaddy served, my daddy served, my childhood friend who I grew up with just got killed in Afghanistan. I've got to give something back to this community. I've been so blessed. I've been healthy. I've been all over the country hunting for a living as a young 22-year-old, 23-year-old, doing all that. And I'm like, man, I've got to do something. So that prompted me to join. When Charlie got killed, it prompted me to join. So I went to a recruiting station and walked into an Army recruiter and said, I want to go to Iraq. That's where I want to go. I want to fight. I want to get revenge on Charlie. And he looked at me like I was crazy and pretty much said, well, you got to do this, you got to do that, and it's going to take a couple of weeks. And I said, I don't think you understand, sir. I said, I want to go right now. And he was like, no, it's going to take some time to get through that. So I walked out of his office, went to the next door down, which was a Marine Corps recruiting station, walked in there, and I said, hey, the Army says it's going to take me 3 or 4 weeks to get into the Army and get to Iraq. Can you do better than that? And they said, you walked into the right place. And I said, well, I ain't kidding. When can I go to boot camp? And they said, well, we've got a bus leaving on Friday, and this was on a Monday. And we pushed everything through, and I signed up on that Monday, and Friday I shipped to Parris Island. And so that's sort of how it prompted me to get into the Marine Corps a little bit later in life.
That speaks to the Marine Corps for sure. They make things happen. I always say I love having Marines around me because you guys make stuff happen. I got to take into consideration that is never going to be how I would do it, and just to stay out of your way. And then I'm probably going to have my feelings hurt as well. And I think that speaks to your character and your personality, Brandon, in a crazy, in a solid way as well.
Yeah.
So you enlisted in the Marines as an infantryman?
Yes, sir. I went in open contract, and it wasn't until the end where they come back. And when you do open contract, that's just dangerous. But I was thinking in my mind, I just want to go. I actually went in as an 0331 machine gunner. And I tell people all the time that see me now, I'm like, you know, I was actually 6'6" before I entered the Marine Corps, and now I'm 5'5". But I do think I shrunk a little since joining the Marine Corps. But yeah, I was a machine gunner my entire time in the Marine Corps. It was a good move for me at that point in my life. It was divine how I got there. I think it was good that I was a little mature. I had a little life experience in me. I think that helped. And I think what the Marine Corps helped develop was a little bit more structure, a little bit more clarity. And I think that's not just the Marine Corps. I think that was how God was working in my life during that time.
So where was your first duty assignment?
A great place. It's a great tropical place called Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. It's actually probably should be, it also could be considered a combat zone at times, depending on what Saturday night, where you're at. But I spent most of my time Camp Lejeune, a lot of time in Camp Pendleton, California. Spent some time in 29 Palm just because of the workups during the deployment times. Really didn't have a home base really for a long time. We were moving deployment-wise. We were in and out quite a bit. So got to spend some time just a couple times in Iraq. Got to spend some time in the Ukraine. This was before the Ukraine war, obviously. But I didn't go anywhere tropical other than Camp Lejeune.
So Brandon and I would share stories. I would share Air Force stories. He would share Marine stories. And it's like, the Air Force is from Mars and the Marines are from Venus. So it was so different. And I remember one of the stories you shared about one of your officers saying, like, hey, can we have a formation for once where somebody's not bleeding?
That's an accurate statement. Yes.
I was like, what are you talking about? And it's like, oh, yeah, all the fighting. And then Mark Riley, who's one of our classmates, we get along really well. For those viewers and listeners, he was on the podcast earlier, and he was in the band. And he was like, oh, yeah, we used to have formations where people fought. Mm-hmm. I was like, the band? And he's like, oh, yeah, the drum and fife corps used to beat the crud out of the band. So different. What was the best deployment you went on? And then what was a deployment that was just horrendous?
My favorite deployment that I went was in the Ukraine. It was something called Operation Sea Breeze. We spent a little over 6 months there doing joint training tactics with the Moldavians, the Ukrainians, the Macedonians. That was a really cool deployment because that was one of the one times I got to actually spend time with another nation and nations, and that had a significant language barrier, that we were all allies. And so it was really unique to see how much we had in common as just men serving their country. And the time I got to spend in Odessa and the time I got to spend with all those different individuals, I thought that was a really unique experience there, with the food that we ate, the time we got to spend on Libo together with one another. The, you know, there's some things that are universal when it comes to men who serve their country, and that's sacrifice, and that's a dark humor that we get. It's the ability to fight each other and still love each other at the same time, and the competitive nature that existed amongst all of our nations that were working together in that time. It felt like a breath of fresh air for me in my military service time to be with another group of servicemen and women that shared that, and to be able to spend time with them like that outside of combat or deployment like Iraq. And so that was probably my favorite time. I would say one of the tougher times was when we were drawn down out of Iraq. I was attached to a reserve unit at the time, and we were winding down the war in Iraq. This was in 2009, and the rules of engagement had changed significantly to where I felt like it was really more unsafe than anything, and there was a lot of downtime, and I think that traumatized more of our Marines than if we were actually engaged in mission and being mission centric. I think that that downtime and that drawdown time and rules of engagement were changing, that transition made it very, very difficult for a lot of the men and women that we were serving with at the time.
So Brandon, how many years did you spend in the Corps, and why did you decide to get out?
12 years. My last deployment, I got home and got married. Me and my wife bought a house on the VA home loan, which sort of prompted me into the career that I'm at now. My wife got pregnant, and I'd done infantry the entire time, and I just didn't want to be in infantry no more. You spend that long in the Marine Corps in the infantry, you realize things can change. I wasn't the man I was when I went in, when Charlie got killed. I was married. I was getting ready to have a child, just bought a home, and I just decided, like, I can't do the infantry no more. I want to get out of the infantry. And the Marine Corps at the time weren't willing to work with me. And it's always the needs of the Marine Corps, the needs of the nation. And I couldn't get a lateral move out of the infantry no matter what I did. And so my contract was up. I dropped to my R time and I got out. I don't regret it. I would have stayed in longer if given the opportunity. But once again, I think God's just had his hand on me throughout my whole life in a way that's blessed me. And so it happened for a reason, and if it not happened that way, maybe something would have went a different direction in my life, but I think I'm exactly where I need to be right now because of that.
And so did you move back home?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm probably about 45 minutes from where I grew up in a little town called Waynesville, North Carolina. Me and my wife have been there for the past 17 years.
Yeah, great. So what did your transition look like?
Transition is difficult. I think transition is difficult for a lot of people, and for those of you who have listened to and have heard or have read anything from Sebastian Younger, I think he puts it in perspective 100%. And I think that when I got out of the Marine Corps, I was lost. You don't know where you fit back into society. And when you lose that brotherhood and sisterhood, which that's the big thing that people miss, I think, with transition, is the military, you have a brotherhood and sisterhood. And that's not tied to an emotion. That's tied to being part of something bigger than you are and the mission at hand. Whereas friendship is tied to an emotion. It's, I like you, Lloyd. I think you're great. The more I hang out with you, the more I like you. The more that we hang out and the more I like you, the more I want to be around you. That's an emotion tied to that. Where I think brotherhood and sisterhood is the opposite of that. It could be, I don't like Mark Riley. I don't like the fact he's taller than me. He's better looking than me. He was a sergeant major. He can play the drums better than me. Like, I don't like Mark Riley. I really do, but I'm just using this as an example. But I feel safer and know that in a situation, whether we're out at a restaurant or we're out in the community, I feel safer knowing if something was to happen, he's got my back no matter what, and I've got his back no matter what, and we don't even like each other, right? So that level of trust and brotherhood and sisterhood, I think Sebastian Younger talks about it better than me, is what is missing in transition. And so you feel isolated, you feel withdrawn, you don't know where you fit into your community. And I was no different. Nobody's immune to that. I didn't know where to fit in. I was cutting meat at a food line grocery store, trying to figure out what I'm going to do with my life. And I got turned down to getting a sponsorship to go to a police academy. And I just didn't know what I wanted to do. And you get to drinking, you know, it's part of the thing in the Marine Corps. They really, I won't say they promote it, but it's a part of that culture. And you find solace there, and walked into a veteran service office to get that home loan that me and my wife were looking to buy a house, and tripped and fell into a Beirut, Lebanon Marine, Ronald Putnam. And he said, "What'd you do in the Corps, boy?" And I told him I was a machine gunner, and he talked me into filing a little bitty petty disability claim, which was not what I was after at the time. Filed that claim and got my home loan stuff squared away. And it was about 2 or 3 weeks later, he called me up and offered me a part-time job. I was like, well, I can get on with this. I can work my angle and hustle for a couple of days during the week at this county service office and work the weekends at Food Lion still and work 7 days a week because I was hustling. And turned to find out I really liked helping veterans and learning how to file disability claims and 1010 easy forms to get into the VA hospital systems and navigating all that for other individuals, and offered me that part-time job. And that's sort of what launched me into my career. During that same time, though, you know, I was struggling. And if it had not been for my wife really setting me straight on what I wanted out of life and to get me back on track with some mental health and stopping the drinking as much as I was. And once again, God put in my path Ronnie Putnam and give me a job and give me a career and put me on a new trajectory of a new mission that I had. And that was helping my brothers and sisters who had served in the military. Fast forward, he left to go work for the state and a director position opened up, and I was offered to apply, and I applied, didn't think I was going to get it. There was over 100 applicants. They interviewed close to 15 individuals, and for whatever reason, they picked this little short Marine to run that office. And that's how I started as a County Veteran Service Director for Haywood County, and did that for 5 years before I went to work for the state.
I want to talk about a Marine Corps officer that stopped into the your office one day, and he had just signed his name on the entry log and to come see you. Can you talk a little bit about who that was?
Yeah, it was a Thursday mid-afternoon, and I'm sitting in my office, and I had a no-show actually happened with a veteran that was coming to see me. So I was getting caught up on some paperwork there, and a guy come in to my secretary there and asked to speak to me and wrote his name down. And she said, "You have a visitor, you got time?" And I said, "Man, I'm really trying to get caught up with paperwork," but I never said no to anybody that wanted to talk to me. So she sent him over, and he opened the door, and it was former Marine Corps Commandant General Carl Mundy. I was still fresh out of being out of the military, and I popped to attention as soon as I could, and it was sort of in like this shock and awe. And he said, "Oh, sit down. And we had a great conversation. He had heard about some of the great work I was doing for our veterans there in the county. His wife was from Haywood County. And that conversation led to a breakfast, which led to a lunch, which led to a couple of dinners with his wife and my wife together at his favorite Italian joint, Pasquale's, there in Hazelwood. And he became a mentor of mine. And he was a mentor of mine for pretty much 3 years. We talked on a regular basis when I decided to take a move up to the state of North Carolina. Like, we talked about that. And he really helped me a lot. I would say not just with my professional development and my career path, but personally in my transition. I think he really understood transitioning out of the Marine Corps into the civilian sector, what needed to happen. And I look back now and can surgically dissect conversations that me and him had and where he took them. And now I can see exactly what he was doing to set me up for success or make me feel a certain way about my life decisions. And so eternally grateful for General Mundy. Funny story about him at Pasquale's one night, my wife was pregnant. Funny man. He said, "You know what you're having yet?" And I said, "No, we don't. We don't haven't decided yet if we're going to find out or not." And my wife, she was pretty pregnant at the time. And he said, "Well, you want to know?" And I said, "Sure." He said, "Well, look," he said, "this is going to sound odd." He said, "but if you let me rub your wife's belly, then I will let you know if you're going to have a boy or a girl." And of course, his wife was like slapping him, like, "You can't do that." And my wife looks at me real funny. I was like, "You let the general rub whatever he wants, dear. This is the commandant," right? And so sure enough, he rubbed her belly a little bit and he said, "You're going to have a girl." It was about 3 months later, Daisy Gail Wilson popped out and it was a girl, sure enough. That's just a funny story about General Mundy. He meant a lot to me in my life, still does. And Lloyd, you were with me in Washington, D.C. Every time I'm in D.C., I go to the Army-Navy Club. And there is a huge photo and portrait of General Mundy that's been in there for a long time. And every time I'm in D.C., I make it a point to go by there and visit General Mundy there with his portrait. I get a picture with me and him. He is buried in Waynesville, where my hometown is, and I go see him once or twice a year at his gravesite. But in D.C., I always get a picture with me and him on the wall there and sent it to both his sons.
And that was real special to me. So at the Bush Institute, there was a handful of really, really, really special times. You know, one was me and Mark walking like midnight in the mall area, visiting all the Christian tents that were set up. And then another one was going with you to the Army Navy Club. We started off with a group of about 15 of us having dinner. And then me and Brandon started to look for the portrait because they moved the portrait.
They moved
it. If you haven't been to the Army Navy Club, this place is humongous and multi-floored. So me and Brandon are looking everywhere for this portrait. And then we're asking people. And the two of us were the last two standing.
Yep. But we found them, didn't we?
We found them. And you told me the whole story. And man, that was really special for me as well. So you're killing it in the state agency there. You're helping a lot of people. Can you talk about the next role? Because the next role was really a big move up, not only a big move up professionally, but a big move up on scale and the service you're providing and the number of people you were helping.
I was real fortunate. I spent a lot of time learning VA law and different ways to get veterans their benefits. And at the time, the Camp Lejeune water contamination was really, really young. This was in 2010. And there was a lot of things that were still bubbling up. It had not become a presumptive condition yet. And I was really fortunate to work with former North Carolina U.S. Senator Richard Burr and some of his committee that he had tasked with trying to figure out what is going on with the Camp Lejeune water, what needs to happen to get the VA to see this as a presumptive condition. So I worked really, really hard on that committee and did a lot of stuff on the background with the Agency of Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. I was winning those claims as a veteran service officer before it was presumptive, right? And so worked a lot with Louisville, Kentucky's regional office. That's where most of those claims were done at the time. And it really put me on the map a little bit of how we help rural veterans. And it was one of the times I got to testify before the House Veterans Affairs Committee on rural health care and the Camp Lejeune stuff. And there was a gentleman there that was running for the governor of North Carolina, Mr. Pat McCrory, reached out to me after he'd heard that testify. And he said, when I win governor, you're going to come work for me. And I'm like, whatever. I'm going to go back to Waynesville and do my thing. And sure enough, he became governor. And it was shortly after that, I went to work for him, went work for the state of North Carolina for the Division of Veterans Affairs. Was really fortunate to work for another amazing two-star general, Cornell Wilson, as we worked to make the Division of Veterans Affairs into the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. So I was really fortunate during that time to work with Mr. Ilario Pantano, General Cornell Wilson. We helped develop and take a Division of Veterans Affairs and turn it into a true cabinet-level agency in the state of North Carolina. I was a real big part of that, and I got to be Assistant Secretary for Veterans Affairs, where we were able to make some really big changes in North Carolina and got to really push projects like the Wartime Veteran Scholarship, the property tax exclusion that exists in North Carolina was a big part of that. The Disabled Veteran Tags in North Carolina was a big part of that. And in training, like that was when fast track claims and fully developed claims were being brought up. And I got to be a real big part of some of what that looked like with Secretary Shinseki and others at the VA. And so it really put me on the map a little bit on how to make change and how to make systems change at a macro level. And I could really see that you can make a lot of changes in people's lives at the county level, which was great. And it was really rewarding. But as I have continued to grow up, I think seeing the opportunities to change policy, to change law, and to make decisions and to push initiatives that not only change one person's life, but changes thousands of veterans' lives and household lives by the work that you do. It takes a little bit more time. It's a little bit of a slower burn than seeing it up front and just filing a claim. But I think that that's where change is made. And I think that's where great leaders that I've had the opportunity to work with, to work for, to be mentored by, has really instilled in me, and that is to continue to push systems level changes, because that's where you can really see a lot of change in the way that our veterans community is transitioning out of service and continue to transition after service.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you were doing huge things, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, take the kind of story where it needs to go. But if I remember right, the governor was not reelected.
Yeah, well, he was not reelected on some stuff, on some foundations and principles that he stood on. I'll say that I was a little naive when I took that appointment, because I figured that veterans was a bipartisan kind of way to look at things, and I would be safe, but it is not. If you were appointed by a Republican governor, you're a Republican. If you're appointed by a Democrat governor, you're a Democrat, no matter what your party affiliation is. And it was unique because Governor Cooper, who came in behind him, was going to terminate me because of my political affiliation. And I knew him. He was our Speaker of the House. I have a great relationship with him. He's no longer our governor now. He's moved on and running for Senate now. But I think it is funny how things work. I was going to be let go of the agency and then ended up being a senior advisor for one of his new teams, where I got to sort of put the nail to him a little bit on a couple of times. And I was like, sir, if you'd have just kept me on staff, you could tell me what to do, but you can't tell me what to do now. All fun. But there's a mutual respect and a deep respect for one of both of us. But I think it was a part of God's plan, Lloyd. I think that when I left that position, I was able to do some freelance consulting for a little bit, went to work for a local management entity for a little bit, but more importantly, applied for a grant that for an organization that I was not working for at the time against the Asheville Buncombe Community Christian Ministry. And Reverend Scott Rogers, the CEO there, which is a faith-based nonprofit, he called me up during that grant application and said, Brandon, if you guys win the grant, we want to support you. We want to be alongside you and be a part of that grant. However, if we win the grant, I want to offer you a job to come to my team and work for me. So, Lloyd, it's the only grant that I've ever applied for that I knew I was going to win no matter what. And I did not win the grant for the organization I was working with at the time. I actually lost, but 3 weeks later, I come to work for ABCCM, and I think that's exactly where I need to be today. Faith is a big part of my life. When I worked for the state of North Carolina, I actually got sued twice for praying in a public setting because there is such thing as separation of church and state. And I can say right now today at ABCCM, we start every meeting with prayer. We end every meeting with prayer, and nobody's looking to sue me for prayer anymore.
I love how the tide's turning. We're seeing.
That's right.
NFL athletes praying openly now. I was just at a promotion ceremony for a good friend of mine who pinned on Fulbert Colonel, and was very happy that that promotion ceremony started after the national anthem. We had a prayer.
Awesome.
And it's yes, all because awesome. of people like us that are not afraid of it. So talk a little bit about what the organization does.
Yeah, so faith-based nonprofit, we've been around since 1969, way before I even got here. I'm definitely standing on the shoulders of a lot of men and women who come before me here. We are a larger faith-based nonprofit. When most people think of faith-based nonprofits, they don't think of really large scale, but we have about 400 staff on our team. We have offices across the state of North Carolina, from Asheville to Fayetteville to Charlotte, Raleigh, Jacksonville. We have a pretty big portfolio of programs for veterans, from housing to employment to suicide prevention to care coordination. But we also have another side of the house where we also provide for civilians as well. And we have 4 crisis ministries, a jail and reentry program. We have 2 other transitional housing facilities in addition to our large veterans facility. We have a free medical clinic, and it's not a federally qualified health center. I like to always say that. It is a true free medical clinic providing care to those most in need. And so about half of our portfolio is veteran household facing. We've grown into that as we have continued to scale programs where the need goes. So really fortunate to be where I'm at right now, surrounding myself with a lot of amazing leaders, some of which are retired colonels, some of which are lance corporals from the Marine Corps, and a lot of them are family members. But it takes a true melting pot for all of us to work together in order to provide the best care we can for our communities.
We had a lot of discussions to talk about the flooding that happened up in Asheville and in that area. And can you talk a little bit about how your organization stepped and helped with that? And it's out of the news now. And then it's unfortunate out of the news now, because I know a lot of people are still struggling. Can you talk about that as well?
Yeah, so we were really fortunate not to lose anyone during the hurricane here at ABCCM, or was under our care. Our Veterans Restoration Quarters is a 250-bed facility located right next to the Swannanoa River. Even though we were outside the 500-year floodplain, up to 8 feet of water come into our own space. And all of our veterans were evacuated that morning in September. And so they were displaced. Luckily, no one was injured. Everybody's okay. We took a place in the community. We had two warehouses, one being a larger warehouse. We activated our churches. We have close to 6,000 unique volunteers a year that comes through. And to see not just ABCCM, what we were able to provide, but how organizations were working together during that aftermath to support individuals, it was remarkable. We had people from New York and Alabama and Florida and all over the place that were sending supplies to our warehouse so we could then deploy them out to those most in need. We worked really closely with the state. We worked closely with FEMA, but it was just really an interesting time. The amount of devastation that we saw, that we experienced, was cataclysmic. I mean, I'm just going to say that it was, hurricanes aren't supposed to happen in the mountains, Lloyd, but we were lucky. We are rebuilding the VRQ. We have been really fortunate. I will say that both HUD and FEMA, as aggravating as both those agencies can be, we have gotten to a positive resolution with both of those. We were able to purchase a hotel across the street from the VRQ at the time. That's where all of our veterans are at now. We're still able to keep the VA grant per diem program intact and being able to keep the integrity of that program going while we are working on rebuilding. FEMA has obligated over 90% back of public assistance for the VRQ with a pretty sophisticated flood mitigation plan that we're working with that as well. And so we're hoping to break ground on that actually in the next 30 to 45 days and hope to be back in it by next fall. Really fortunate during the hurricane. A lot of great things come out of the hurricane that we were not anticipating. The community coming together like anything else, much like 9/11 that happened. It's amazing how the community come together on one common goal and one common purpose. I do think it's a shame that sometimes it takes something major like that or a traumatic event to happen for our nation to come together and communities to come together. But when it does, it's a beautiful thing. And so we want to ride on that wave and keep that momentum going and just keep that same kind of positive energy and collaboration moving in Western North Carolina. And I think it will. I think that one of the things about Appalachian folks is that's who we are. It's our nature, right? We've had to go without for so long. We're used to it, right? Let's figure it out together. But yeah, we were real fortunate during that time period.
What are the greater needs now of the Western North Carolina area?
You know, at the end of the day, affordable housing is a thing. We have lack of housing, much less lack of affordable housing. And so one of the things that ABCCM has taken, that's why we're rebuilding the VRQ. And so we're going to rebuild the VRQ, which is going to create 242 transitional beds, another 65 emergency beds. And with the approval from HUD, with the hotel that we just bought, we're going to have 134 permanent supportive housing units for veterans. And so when you add all those numbers up, you know, you're pushing on over 400 beds for male veterans is one project. We also have other projects going on with our women and children's facility. We're adding 68 more transitional units there, and we're going to add 35 permanent supportive housing units for our females and females with children. A lot of those beds we have at Transformation Village now, which is our female facility. A lot of those beds are dedicated beds for female veterans. 20 of those are female veteran beds, but we always have more than 20 female veterans there. It's just we have 20 dedicated for female veterans. And so I would just say this, like, continue to think about how you can support Western North Carolina. This recovery effort that we're in, we're open for business, but there's still places and pockets in these hollers that don't have power. There are still places 2 years later where bridges have not been rebuilt. You know, there's people that we take, veterans right now, that we actually take generators to, multiple generators, because generators aren't meant to run all the time. And so we've had to take multiple generators, and they'll run a generator for 1 week, cut it off, and turn the other one on for a week. These are Appalachian hills and hollers where you wouldn't know they were at, even if there was a road there, right? And so continue to keep North Carolina in your prayers, Western North Carolina in your prayers. If you want to get involved, we'd love to show you. It don't have to be just to ABCCM. We are community-minded, community-based, and it's taken all of us to get together. But you can obviously anytime visit our website at abccm.org and learn all about that, or reach me or reach our team to how you can get involved. You know, everybody that sends $10 goes a long way in this community. And so there's nothing less. But the biggest thing you could probably give to us, Lloyd, that I would say is to uplift Western North Carolina in your prayers every night and the people who are here.
Yeah, absolutely. You're like me. You've got more job titles than the Pope. You're now a chairperson for a Congressional Veterans Advisory Committee for U.S. Congress. Can you talk a little bit about that?
North Carolina's 11th District Congressman currently is Chuck Edwards. I have sat on this congressional committee several times. I sat on it with Blue Dog Democrat Congressman Heath Shuler, who was a great Tennessee football Hall of Famer from Swain County. I was fortunate to sit on his congressional committee for a while. He was an awesome individual to work for. Congressman Mark Meadows, Trump's former chief of staff, held this seat for a while. I was on his congressional committee, and now this seat is held by Congressman Chuck Edwards. And it's a renewed and revamped committee. I think it went several years without it even being in existence after Congressman Meadows left office. For lots of reasons, it did not ever just reactuate itself. And I think Congressman Edwards reached out to me and said, hey, can you lead this effort again since you've done it before? And so I think one of the things, Lloyd, that I'm going to continue to do is, regardless of what congressman is in office, this is a veterans subcommittee on work and congressional committee to support veterans and rural veterans at that in Western North Carolina. And so part of me is sort of like taking this by the horns now and saying, if Chuck Edwards, you're not in office next year or 2 years from now or 5 years from now, and it's somebody else, the committee's still going to be in existence. And I think that's just being leaders, and you don't have to wait on a politician to have a committee. I think you just take it by the horns and just make it what it needs to be. And when he or she gets into office, you just let them know this is the committee, right? And we're sort of thinking about being self-governed in that way. But the idea is to actually give Congressman Edwards raw information about what's working at the VA, what's not working at the VA, what are the true needs of veterans in Western North Carolina. I think too many times Congress and VA both will allocate resources and funding to problems that don't really exist in the ecosystem because they're looking at data that was dated 3 and 4 years ago. So the more that we can be real and in time with our feedback, with our voices, that can help push that resource allocation or funding to organizations to actually address the right things, the better off our veterans community will be. And so that's sort of what this committee is looking at right now and working with the VA. The VA is a part of the committee, but it's a good makeup of folks. We have spouses, we have service members, we have retirees, we have just old grumpy old Marines like myself who just did a stint in time. So it takes all of us, I think, coming together to talk about those things. So yeah, excited about the committee. Just like you said, Lloyd, one of the many hats that both of us wear to help our veterans communities.
Yeah, awesome. Amazing. I know we both of us have struggled finding time to relax, but when you do have time, what do you like to do to relax? What are some of your hobbies?
Well, if I could be anywhere right now, other than with you, Lloyd, right now on this podcast, it would be on my boat in Charleston, South Carolina. I have a little center console boat, not a big boat. It's a little, you know, 25-foot little center console boat. And I love having it on the water. I like the salt water better, but we do take it around the lakes here in Western North Carolina quite a bit. But that's the one thing that I love for me, just personally me, for my space. Outside of that, I'm a soccer dad. Both my young girls, my 10-year-old and my 14-year-old, are soccer players to the core. And so most weekends we're on the field and I'm hanging out watching soccer all weekend and going to games all over the region. But the boat's the place that I find my solace.
Tell our listeners and viewers when you started saving for that boat and then when you purchased that boat.
Yeah. I started saving some birthday money when I was 16 years old. I'd always wanted to have a center console boat my entire life, and I knew it was expensive. And like I said, I come up with humble beginnings. And so I started saving at 16, birthday money here, tax return here, deployment money here, just hit and miss. And I'd say I've had my boat now for close to 9 years now, but it took me from 16 to about 38 before I was able to buy the boat that I wanted. And it's the only thing that I own outright, Lloyd. Everything else can fall to pieces. I own it. It is only in my name. Everything else is in my wife's name and in my name, but the boat is in my name. And so, you know, my grandfather taught me the value of saving money. And so I think that's a valuable lesson I hope I can give to my girls.
And I bet you take real good care of that boat, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I pay every year to keep it in Charleston, South Carolina in a climate control garage. But just because it's the one thing that I treasure that much is the material.
Yeah, I know if you work for something really hard, you're going to take care of it. And I have a pontoon boat that I bought last year, Brandon has a story. And so you go into the marina, there's these beautiful, expensive boats that are just falling apart because, you know, people don't take care of them. And I'm the kind of guy, I'm putting the protectant on my seats. Every time I go, I'm wiping them every off. Every time. When you're from a working class, you have to save money to do something like that. That's awesome, brother. Well, it's been so great. I'm not going to say to get to know you because I know all these stories already, because we were able to spend some quality time. I can't wait until I get up to Asheville and come see the facilities and then meet your family. So that's going to happen in the future. But before we close it out, what advice can you offer to a veteran that is maybe struggling right now?
You went into the military. You're way more capable of doing great things in the civilian sector and in life in general than you think you are. I think that the confidence that the military instilled in you should just carry you into this transition, and know that. Find a mentor. That's the one thing that I think that really helped me. I was really fortunate to have General Mundy at such an early part of my transition, but look for a mentor. Look for another veteran who's been there, that's done that, and attach yourself to him or her and ask questions and let them guide you and be open to that. I mean, if anything else, it's a conversation that you can have with a brother or sister in arms that you don't have to worry about judgment. You don't have to worry about some bias, and you can tell some of those dark jokes too, and they're not going to look at you crazy because they get it and they'll laugh out loud. And so I think that finding that place is important. So I would just say, keep the faith, find a mentor, and find your place, because this country today needs more veterans in leadership positions. We need more veterans in C-suites. We need more veterans in politics. We need more veterans in any leadership position in the community, because I think there's a sense of common sense that you have and a strength that you have to make this country a better place and where it needs to go. And so I would say, that's what I would say. I would say, be strong in who you are, be confident in who you are, and find your new tribe, because it exists.
Great advice, Brandon. And we need more veterans like Brandon Wilson, whether they're in Western North Carolina or in New York City. We need more Brandons. So with that, I'm going to end the podcast like I always end it. Be like my friend, my good friend, Brandon Wilson. Be safe, be kind, and be remarkable.
The Tango Tango podcast is proudly sponsored by Supply Chain Now. Join the Tango Tango community for more inspiring stories. Follow us on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn. Subscribe to the Tango Tango YouTube channel. And follow and listen to Tango Tango wherever you get your podcasts.